Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, and very good evening to you all. Welcome to the LSE Department of Economic History's annual Epstein Lecture. I'm Sarah Horrell. I'm the head of department in the Economic History Department, and it's my privilege to chair this event. This year, it's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Paula Gobey to be our Epstein lecturer. But before I properly introduce her, I want to give you some housekeeping notes, please. This is a hybrid event, so we've got people online as well as obviously yourselves in the room. So it is recorded, so please bear that in mind when you're asking questions and things later. Paula will give the talk and we'll take questions at the end of the talk. For those that are online, can you put your questions into the chat and then we'll pick them up and read some of them out as we go through. For those of you in the room, if you can wait till you've got the microphone before you ask any questions, that'd be most helpful. People will come around with microphones for that. So let me just say a little bit about this lecture series. It's an annual lecture series that was established in the memory of Professor Larry Epstein. He was a dearly missed colleague in the Department of Economic History. He was a mentor to many economic historians. I wasn't fortunate enough to be actually benefiting from his mentorship. I didn't have him around in my early career. But there are many in the room, I think, who have benefited from his support, advice, academic guidance, and what's been described as vigorous scrutiny. And I think they'll attest to the importance of his mentorship in their work and their careers. This lecture is intended to showcase the work of rising stars in economic history. As I said, our lecturer this year is Paula Gobey. She's a professor at the Université Libre de Brussels and also a CEPR research fellow. Since 2024, she's been director of ECARES, the European Centre for Advanced Research in Economics and Statistics. She has a book on inequality in Belgium and numerous articles in top journals in a variety of fields. I counted, I think, 14 different sort of top journals in various fields. They range from those in economics to demography to political economy and, of course, economic history. The topics cover aspects of fertility change and the relationship of population size, childcare arrangements, inheritance and female empowerment. Geographically, she ranges from, sub-Saharan Africa to Italy to France, all over the place, and covers a large time span. And in 2020, she received a large ERC grant to investigate inheritance, demographics, and economic development that we're going to be hearing more about tonight. I won't preempt it, but it develops a structural model and understands how family structures and developments interact. Paula has definitely advanced our knowledge in these areas and produced really important research that demonstrates how economic history is of relevance to some of today's most pressing problems, economic growth and population change. Today, she'll talk about this in this lecture, Inheritance, Demographics and Economic Development. Give a warm welcome, please, to Paula Gobey.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for all these kind words. Okay, so I'm really honored to be here, and it's my pleasure to share with you what I've been doing the past years. And so this is, as Sarah said, this is a research project that was funded by the ERC a couple of years ago on inheritance, demographics, and economic development. So let's begin, and I'll ask you to imagine that you're the third son of a peasant family in the south of France in the mid of 17th century. So this little boy, this is you. So your eldest brother inherits the family farm. Your sisters might marry if there's enough for a dowry, and you inherit nothing. So your choices in life are quite limited. It's harder for you to marry, to form a household, to have children, and even to invest a little money for whatever dream you dreamt of doing. So all these choices depend very little on your skills on your preferences, but they depend a lot on the inheritance law. So the way societies have transmitted wealth down across generations really have shaped societies, demography, and it has been like that for centuries, and it still happens today. So inheritance matters. It matters today, and it matters at different levels. Economists have mostly studied the way it matters for capital accumulation, for inequality, for economic growth. Sociologists have mostly looked at how inheritance laws affect the way households organize themselves. For instance, a more egalitarian type of inheritance, like, is connected with a society in which families are more nuclear. That's the type of families we see today, where like parents live with their children. Societies in which inheritance is more unequal, these are societies in which households turn around like the asset that you don't want to divide, the castle or the family farm. And that's linked with more complex or extensive type of families. So today we're going to study how it affects individual choices regarding fertility, marriage, and migration. So when I started this project, one thing that struck me the most is that although there is a big literature in economics on how inheritance affects, let's say, long-run determinants, the more macro type of literature, and there's also a literature in demographics and family economics, like, few people have linked these two together. And that, I thought, was surprising, because if you read it, historians, social scientists, they always, like, come up with this call of iron chain between inheritance and reproduction that is achieved through marriage. So I said, whoa, what are we missing in economics if we don't bring this connection at the first place? So the objective of this lecture is to understand a little bit how important are these interconnections between inheritance laws and demographics in a context of economic development. So to do that, we're going to study it, let's say, the three main dimensions in demographics: fertility, marriage, and migration, and we'll study them in relevant context for each of them. Relevant context of fertility, we'll look at the first fertility transition in the world, which is the case of France, and we'll look at fertility today in sub-Saharan Africa, which is like very high, and we still don't understand why it has been going up. What are the forces that have been keeping fertility in Africa so high? We're going to look at marriage in the context of the European marriage pattern, and we're going to look at migration in the context of 19th century Italy. All these relevant contexts to study each of the demographic dimensions. So let's go through the fertility. So what are the main determinants that we know push fertility up and down? We can classify them into economics and health patterns. So the economics factors are GDP per capita and female education. The first one, you can think that as economies grows, then these economies start asking for more skilled labor, and that triggers inside families higher investment into raising and educating children with respect to how many children you might want to have. Female education: when women start getting more and more educated, their wage in the labor force gets high, and so anything they do outside of the labor force is more expensive. And so these opportunity costs that women face creates an incentive to do less of these other things outside the labor place, and since having children takes a lot of time, they become more costly. Then there's also a health literature that has shown that as health improves, people also have fewer children. So these factors, despite being very important, they cannot fully explain two important cases. The first is France at the early fertility decline in France. And the French case is very anecdotal because it's the first in the world, 100 years before any other fertility transition in Europe, 50 years before the American one, which is also like little understood up to now. And so like studying the demographic transition without understanding the French case, it's like studying the Industrial Revolution without understanding the English case. And the second thing that these factors cannot fully explain is why sub-Saharan African fertility still keep being so high and has been so slow in declining, which has consequences in the United Nations projections that keep on like updating the population trends upwards, and not because they are wrong in predicting the mortality part, it's because it's so hard to predict the fertility part of the projection. So why should inheritance affect fertility to start with? So like that's kind of like the conceptual framework that we will play around. And so you can think that yourself as a farmer in a world in which your farm is never going to be divided, and in a world in which if you choose to have 9 children, it will be divided in 9. So if you like have a farmer friend, you know that dividing this farm is very harmful for the farm, because you don't want to do that, like because you might fall under a certain level in which the farm is completely useless. So if you have that in mind, and you know that you're in this type of the world, maybe you're not going to have 9 children, and you're going to refrain, and you're going to end up with 3. So this force that pushes you to not fragmenting your farm until it's like too much broken up is going to also diminish the number of heirs that you might end up having. Okay, so let's walk through the first paper that we started in this project, which is joined with Victor Gay, who's a professor in Toulouse School of Economics and Diast, and with Margoni, who will see it's a common suspect all throughout this project. It was at the University of Bergen and the CPR. Okay, so the puzzle of the French demographic transition, as I said, it's the early timing and also this acceleration part. So this figure shows fertility rates across different ways of measuring, but it shows basically two things. So that before the revolution, it was already declining slowly, and it has been shown that the fertility transition in France has started at the beginning of the 18th century. And then you see an acceleration. So basically, the early timings at odds of like that link fertility declines with any change related to industrial revolution, like that we need skills as in the labor force, and it's also at odd with slow-moving factors that make fertility adjust slowly, which mostly relate to culture factors. So in this paper, we're gonna try to understand how the changes introduced during the revolution might have like make this decline faster. So this hypothesis, so these changes that we're looking, you might guess, these are the same changes associated with inheritance laws. And this hypothesis that the changes in inheritance laws that have abolished any sort of impartibility or an egalitarian way of dividing the estate, that this was one of the forces that pushing fertility downwards, is a hypothesis associated with a sociologist, Frédéric Leplay, who says that all stable families have been destroyed in France by the revolution and the civil code, and these families now seek in the sterility of marriage a way to avoid the fragmentation of small properties. Okay, so before the revolution, France was a mosaic of inheritance laws, and I will show the mosaic, but we will play around two categories, the unequal inheritance, equal inheritance. Under unequal inheritance, you have all sort of like one heir, primogenitor, ultimogenitor, unigenitor, and we also include here women excluded. Some places you could divide your estate, but women were excluded, which was the typical case of Normandy. And then you have equal inheritance, which is you partition your wealth equally among your children. Inheritance reforms, what they do, all the country turns into equal inheritance. And the mechanism that we want to understand is whether this increasing the number of heirs now limits the number of children. Okay? So what we do is we test the place hypothesis, we construct new data, and we do so with a difference in difference in a strategy in which we compare the areas that were before unequal to the areas that were before equal already across women that were not affected by the reform, that were too old to change the fertility behavior, and across women that were still in their fertile life. Okay, then we augment that for a special regression issue to discontinuity given the quality of the data that we will construct. Okay, so this quote, I find it quite fascinating because it's from a politician in the 1791 that actually anticipates the hypothesis of Frédéric Leplay and says that this equal share that one would be obliged to give to their younger siblings might even prevent them from being born. So I find that It gives you the like how much these people were thinking about all the dimensions of every reform they were pushing at that time. So we do find that these inheritance reforms decrease the fertility by around 5.5 to 0.6 children. Is that a big thing? Well, in terms of like overall implications, you do see a conversion in fertility rates across the two type of areas. We had before unequal areas and equal areas. Like there was already lower fertility in these areas in which you had equal inheritance, and then after the reform, they converged to the same fertility pattern. We can explain 44% of the fertility decline in the first phase of the demographic transition, which is often characterized as a rural phase, and like 36% of the whole fertility decline. So we think that this is a very important element to fully understand the fertility transition. So why did, like, to give you a little bit of fun context, why did the revolutionaries reform inheritance laws? So this is, I think, like, this is very interesting because these inheritance laws, like, were there for at least 8 centuries before they start changing. So, like, why do they do it? They were quite in the blood of any person, no matter where they were living in unequal areas or equal areas. So the first reason is, of course, the revolution was all about abolition of privileges. Being the solo heir is part of a privilege. You want equality for everyone. The second one is that France was very fragmented, pretty much a mess in terms of boundaries. You had boundaries for customs, you had boundaries for administrative issues, you had boundaries for religious issues. So they wanted to kind of like harmonize all that. And Voltaire has a nice quote that it's quite known, who says that a man who traveled in these countries changes laws, inheritance laws, almost as many times as he changes post horses. But the key reason that we read in the archives of the revolution is to prevent fathers that would be against the revolution to disinherit a patriotic son that would like to join the revolutionary forces by disinheriting him, because it would be the only way for the father to kind of like put the authority on that. So it was not about fertility concerns at all. Inheritance concerns were not part of these popular grievances, the cahier de doléances. Like, it was not about that. Take up and enforcement, something that I would like to say, is that I told you that these inheritance laws had been there for a long period of time. Well, now, how likely is the new law to be taken up by the population? But so imagine that you're a daughter, one of these daughters in Normandy, you get nothing from the inheritance, now you have these rights. Wouldn't you fight for that? So everyone would.
I would.
So basically, we constructed database on inheritance laws before the revolution came and harmonizes everything. And to do that, we have to follow some steps. And we start from what's called the bailliage, which were judicial districts. So this is the underlying unit at which laws would apply to. Okay? In 1789, this unit was the one chosen to send representatives to the General Estates. So we have a complete list of the bailliage, and there is Armand Bret who creates an atlas of that. So we georeference and digitize that and provide a new map of judicial districts in France. Now, each judicial district followed a certain law, which was customary. So every like polygon here like follows a customary law. So the second step, we need to link each judicial district to a certain law. Okay, and we count 141 laws. And inside each law, you have to code what was the proper inheritance law. For that, we go to the customs themselves that get written in, like, by definition, customary law is oral, but in the middle of the 15th century, Charles VII in France orders the writing and the codification of all the laws of his kingdom. So we have, like, these documents. And so we go through them, and for instance, this is an example of the custom of Brittany, who says that the children will split the inheritance equally. First, the male will choose their part, and then the daughters will follow. While in Normandy, like, the daughters didn't have any part of the share. So we put that into a database, and that's the mosaic I was talking to you about. Okay, so you see, like, there is quite a, we have a big category. At the end of the day, we'll be comparing, like, what is dashed, like, where you see these yellow lines to where you don't see. But you see that they have red, like, dots, little dashes, and all that. So the red are areas where you only had one air. The blues are areas where you have multiple heirs, but for instance, in Brittany, you had only the brothers were inheriting. So, what's the main result of the picture? I think of the paper. I think this picture shows you that. So, you already have. So, this shows fertility over women's cohort for in places that were inegalitarian and in places that were egalitarian. So, you see already a gap before the introduction of the new laws of inheritance that harmonize them in the country, and you see a convergence that lasts until today. Okay, so that's the story. I don't need to show you more. We do a bunch of robustness. We apply a regression discontinuity where you do the diff and diff, but like close to the border, you know, to be able to compare women that are as close to one another as possible. And if you put that in graph, before the reform, women that were too old to be affected by this reform, you see that at the border there is a difference in fertility across them, or that it completely disappears after the reform. Implications, we can use our empirical models to say, okay, what would have had happened in case of not touching the inheritance laws. Well, that would be the counterfactual. Fertility would have been here, while this is kind of like the real line. So if you compare this gap to this difference here, that's where like the first phase of the demographic transition in France finishes, you get this number of like how much we explain in total for the overall demographic transition. Let's move to sub-Saharan Africa. Is this story relevant for today, sub-Saharan Africa, right? So today, like, the question is a bit not what pushed fertility downwards, but what is keeping fertility so up. And in the context of Africa, you still have many ethnicities that are still following an egalitarian inheritance. Okay? So this picture, you might have seen it recently. Sub-Saharan Africa is still like one of the few places in the world with a fertility, like where women still have above six children, while the rest of the world has converged to below replacement levels. And so the question is, what is keeping sub-Saharan African fertility so high? And this has been asked by demographers and economists who, despite accounting for all the main differences that could affect fertility, they still find kind of like the sub-Saharan Africa dummy of one child. So what will explain that? You know what I'm going to say. It's about inheritance law. But more generally, I have a Journal of Economic Perspective paper in which we claim that it's all the family institutions that include inheritance, but you can also think about polygamy that also matters. Okay, so what we do? Like, we take these two boxes conceptual framework that I showed you at the beginning to the African case, and we show that indeed fertility is still higher under inegalitarian inheritance than under egalitarian inheritance. What we can do in this paper, given that we cover a big area, is to look at another prediction of this conceptual framework, is that if, like, for a farmer, what you care the most is not really the land, but the labor as an input, then this fertility gap between egalitarian and inegalitarian inheritance doesn't really matter. If what you care is not the land itself, but it's the labor as an input of production, then these big differences should not exist anymore. And that's exactly what we find in this case. Okay? So, why is it the case that inheritance laws are still inegalitarian, if you want, in sub-Saharan Africa? Well, that's because the sub-Saharan African case still depends very much on customary law. So customary law is still, you have like a pluralism, you have mixed legal systems in sub-Saharan Africa that come from the colonial time. So when colonizers arrived, they instituted a two-court systems, one for the colonizers, one for the natives, and the natives were like the law that was applied to the natives was customary law. Upon independence, like countries didn't really want to abolish the customary law because they saw that that was their identity and they want to preserve the ethnic diversity behind. And even today, they still follow customary law because of more practical elements like proximity. You understand better the customary law of your ethnicity. You speak the same language. You can pay in all sorts of form. And also, you don't have to go to a city far away to like make your case. Okay? You also have like practical issues that how are you going to, we need enough development to replace all sorts of like customary judges. Okay? So they regulate family issues, including inheritance, and still, and since they are related to an ethnic group, and like ethnic groups are so heterogeneous and diverse, like that's why within countries the law can be very different. Okay, so given that it's ethnicity law, we can use the ethnographic atlas. Recently, we have like there is quite a lot of critiques recently about the ethnographic atlas. There was a conference here at LSE actually about the validity of the ethnographic atlas. One of the last things we did is actually look at additional sources not used by Murdoch himself to like recheck all the ethnicities, the inheritance level of all the ethnicities in our sample, and 80% we find like sort of like sources that go in the same direction of Murdoch for 80% of our sample, and for 20% we found an ambiguity in the sources that we were finding. Okay, so we connect that with the demographic and health survey that has information on fertility, and then we do standard things in the literature. So that's it. That's, we create a sample in which we will compare women across pairs. So here we are in Ethiopia. You have three ethnicities: the Darassa, the Guraje, and the Arusi, and we will compare women that are close to a border across one pair. Like here you have two pairs, this and this, and this and this. This is not a pair because they share the same inheritance. Okay, so in bread you have impartible inheritance, in blue you have partible inheritance. The result of that exercise is that under impartible inheritance, where you transmit your family plot on and on to only one heir, like in these women will have 1.2 children more than in areas in which you care about land fragmentation. Okay? We test the second prediction of the theory, which is that, okay, but if you care about land so much, then that's when like this mechanism of land fragmentation matters to me. When what you care as input of production is labor, then it doesn't matter so much. So we create a new index of potential labor intensity based on how likely you are to cultivate certain types of crops versus another. So certain crops are easier in terms of demanding for labor than others. Typically, cereals are very labor demanding versus roots and tubers. So we create like a potential suitability index to cultivate one or versus another, and we find that when like in where you are, what you care the most is labor as an input of production, there, like the inheritance laws do not matter for any fertility differential across inheritance laws. Okay? Takeaway, inheritance matters for the fertility decision in context where agriculture depends in which like the farmers depends a lot on agriculture for subsistence purpose. It matters to explain the French Revolution, and it still matters today to explain why sub-Saharan Africa is still so high in terms of fertility. Now let's look at marriage outcomes, and we'll go through the European marriage pattern for that. This is joint with Matthew Curtis, who's now at the University of Southern Denmark, again with Margoni and with Joanna Dad. Both Joanna and Matt were with me as postdocs a couple of years ago and now they're settled. So European marriage pattern, I think this crowd knows very well what it is, but so to the west of an imaginary line that Hajnal has drawn from Trieste to St. Petersburg, he defined what we call the European marriage pattern. It has some characteristics, which are late marriages around 25 compared to like late teens in the West, high rates of celibacy around 10 to 15 compared to below 5 in the East, and neolocal households, we are close to 80%. So this institution was important because it was shown to limit fertility in Malthusian times, but there's still open questions about these important institutions. First is whether it's responsible for Europe's riches, for like the development of Europe, and then nowadays it's quite accepted there was a lot of local heterogeneity in these institutions, and we're still trying to understand what was driving this heterogeneity. Okay, so to give an anecdotes about what we do in this paper, I will present to you this Helen Wisserman that had returned to her village. She was shown to she was reported for being sexually active but not married. So she was by then in the mid-20s or older, but she was still not settled with a husband and land, because no marriage means no land. So this example, like, is an example of EMP, celibacy, being linked to poverty, financial constraints. I don't have enough to form a household and to marry. But you have other types of women. You have Cecilia and Celestria that had enough land in early 15th century Bridgestock to marry, but she never took a husband. Celestria felt so strongly about not marrying that she paid 2 shillings in 2038 for the privilege of living without a husband for her whole life. And of course, these examples are associate European marriage pattern to riches. So which one is dominating? Okay? So we reconcile these two stories by showing that there's actually a U-shaped relationship between financial independence and the probability of remaining single. So who are the single women of the European marriage patterns? These are those that are very poor, both in terms of not getting inheritance or not getting like any labor. So here we plot economic opportunities in the labor market that we proxy with pastor suitability index, and we do a lot of argumentation to try to claim that this is a good proxy for women labor opportunities in the cases of Belgium and France in rural areas. And where do we see so these single women? We see them here, where they are too poor, no inheritance, no labor opportunities, or they are too rich. They have an inheritance, they have a good job, they don't need a husband. Okay? So that's what we do. So new data on inheritance for Belgium and France. We augment the database in France that I showed you for the French paper. New data on celibacy that we take from genealogical data, and we are aware of all the biases that we go with crowdsourced genealogies, and we can discuss them. I won't have time to enter into these details, but you can ask me anything about it. And then we document new facts, but let's say undocumented facts on the EMP. The first one is that egalitarian inheritance decreases EMP, and by EMP I mean celibacy in rural areas, but it increases celibacy in urban areas, in towns. Okay? So that already gives you the hint that, okay, like having more financial opportunities in rural areas, which it might be harder for women to work, like it's good and allows me to get in the marriage market. In the urban areas where I most likely have a job, if you give me an inheritance on top of that, I'm richer and I don't need a husband.
I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Zooming into the rural areas, women of economic opportunities decrease celibacy under inegalitarian inheritance and increases on egalitarian inheritance. This is just the picture I showed you before. And we show importantly, given that we have this genealogical data, we can go back pretty long period of time and show that these facts are very stable over like the centuries, suggesting that inheritance was very structural to the like behavior of these people. Okay, and then you can say, okay, but do we have more people like Helen or like Celestria? And for that, we will use a structural model of marriage and estimate how many women were single because they were rejected from whatever marriage offer, or they rejected themselves, the person. So we follow the same procedure, the same methodology in France in order to construct more map on inheritance. My dream is to have that for Europe. Maybe someday I'll make it. But so basically we take these like 18th century like maps, we georeference, we digitize them, and we construct geographic information systems for judicial districts, who are the only underlying units to which a customary law would apply. We link them to customs, so the laws themselves. And for this paper, on top of just the general, the most rural customs, we also like gather information on the customs of cities, little of towns. And that's very important if you look into Belgium, that was very urbanized. Okay, so that's the same procedure than for France. We go into the customs of Belgium, and here is the result of these tags. So this is the same picture for France that I showed you before, but we added the urban customs. And you see that the more you move to the north, the more of these you have. And Belgium, that's in which like you had a lot, what we know already. Okay? So let me repeat the style as facts. So first we show that egalitarian inheritance weakens for celibacy in rural areas by 2.6 percentage points, the average 10%, so it's quite meaningful number. Egalitarian inheritance also strengthens, increases celibacy in towns by almost 5 percentage points. And then these U-shaped patterns where we combine women economic opportunities and an inheritance. So we bring these facts to a conceptual framework, to a model, a structural model of marriage decisions, which individuals are characterized by whether they're men or women, by their wage, and by their inheritance status. First, like people are matched to someone and they decide whether to marry or not. And then in a second stage, they organize their life. We use a collective decision model in which they have to share what they have and whether they decide on the consumption of a public good, which is our housing, and that's a very important element because that's what we really connect to the access to inheritance. Based on this, we estimate two types of celibacy: constrained women when they are rejected, empowered women where they reject. So there are three elements that connect inheritance to celibacy. First is inheritance, of course. Inheritance gives you access to a big investment, and forming a household is a big investment, so you need that money. Then the second one, which we use actually data from Sarah on expenditures to estimate the model. Well, it's having a house costs money as well. You have to maintain this house. So this maintenance cost, if you're poor, you might not be so able to pay it. So this puts very poor people in the celibacy type of poverty trap. Then you have the empowerment channel that goes through the household bargaining. I told you that we were using a collective choice model, and therefore in there you have to share your income with your partner. And if I'm very rich and I match with someone who's not that rich, it means that I'm gonna have to pay for his beers. I don't want that. So we estimate a model using simulated transfer moments and like state of the art in this literature, and to estimate where is it that women were rejected and where is it that women were rejecting. And so the brownish areas show where women were single because of constraints, and the more green areas show you where women were single because they rejected. Overall, like we find that the majority of women were actually empowered. So that's what we do. So the EMP is an important institution to understand in the context of early modern Europe. And we show that it's not only a matter of riches or poor, it's a bit of both. And we, with looking at celibacy in particular, we can estimate the share that were single because they were rich or because they were too poor. How much time do we have?
20 minutes.
20 minutes? Oh, okay, I'm going too fast. Okay, so the last part is, which is the most ongoing work in progress paper, is joint with Thomas Baudin, a professor at TSX School of Management, Tommaso D'Amelio, who's a PhD student of mine, who's going to be in the market next year, highly recommended, and Simone Morricone, also a professor at TSX School of Economics. So Italian migration, of course, I'm not exaggerating when I say that is important. It was important by the end of the 19th century, beginning of 20th century, for the how big it was. It covered 10% of all migration waves at that time. It's important for what Italians brought to the countries of destination. It's also important for what is now Italy today. So the migration in Italy, it's very relevant. Before Napoleonic invasion in Italy in the early 19th century, you also had regional and family level variation in inheritance laws. It was mostly Italy was not a bit different compared to Belgium and France, because inheritance law did not really depend on this customary law, but Italy was all under Roman law, and it could deviate at the state level, and it deviated especially with this institution called the Fideicommesso, which was a Roman legal institution that operated through a clause in the testament. So it was a bit like an entail. And what that clause did was it forced the heir to not break the family estate. Okay, so it was a way to preserve the family estate forever, and it could be, as in Scotland, even perpetual. Okay? So of course it was most relevant for noble families, and that's going to be the analysis of this paper. So this I present you to many people. let me present you to this Francesco Dentice, who is son of a prince of Fraso. He was born in Naples in October 6 in 1800. As the little boy of the beginning, he's also the third child of Gerardo Dentice, but not of a peasant family, of a wealthy family. He was not entitled to inheritance under the Fideicommesso. It was his first brother. But then the civil code comes, abolishes the Fideicommesso, and Francesco then he can receive his share upon his father's death. He can pursue a diplomatic career. He transfers his properties through the payment of a fee, and he migrates to Paris, where he dies. What would have been Francesco without the changing laws of Fideicommesso? He wouldn't have any inheritance. As a third son, he would rely on a stipend from his eldest brother. He could not annihilate any share of the family lands. So his career would have been dependent on the willingness of the brother, on family patronage. And for sure, he would have much limited mobility. And that's the story of the paper, basically. So we create novel datasets, maps of inheritance of whether you could use at the state level of Fideicommesso or not. And we reconstruct migration patterns from crowdsourced genealogies from the same database that we used in the previous paper to look into celibacy rates. Okay? Our working hypothesis is whether this abolition of Fideicommesso increase out migration, as was the case of Francesco. I love this quote. So when Napoleon said that Waterloo will wipe out the memory of my 40 victories, but that which nothing can wipe out is my civil code. That will live forever. So that, I think, had impacts along many dimensions of the changes in law, and it's also the case here for Italy through the abolition of Fideicommesso. So what we find is that abolishing Fideicommesso increased out migrations by 5.7 percentage points, but especially among the noble families in Italy, it increases out migration by 22%. It's relevant because it has now, we know that the mass migration, the mass Italian migration of the end of the 19th century actually is originated by a few clusters of people. And so how important were nobles, for the rest, what would come by the end of the 19th century, where we do like an exercise to estimate that, and we find that like the amount of migration that we see at the end of 19th century would have been 25% lower if these institutions wasn't abolished. Okay, so this is the data that we use at the state level. That's an example of a state where that forbids the usage of the fideicomiso. There were four that abolished at different moments in time. The last one was Milan, which we will use as a starting point for our analysis. That's what Italy looks like in terms of the states that do not allow families to use fideicomiso, and the rest that still allow noble families to use it. Okay, so then that's all econometrics. We do a difference in difference approach, exploiting the invasion of Italy by Napoleon, comparing states that were on the fideicomiso before versus those that already did not allow, across peoples that are too old to be able to migrate versus people that are still affected and can still migrate. And that's where we find the numbers that I showed you. Okay, so we also have predictions that are intuitive. We have a model that can explain these outcomes, but it also delivers some predictions. The first one is that we shouldn't see any effect for families with one children. So if you are the only heir, you shouldn't be affected by Napoleon at all. We see that. We also see that the effects are higher where you care a lot about indivisibility. And we can estimate like how much you care about indivisibility by how likely it is that for your estate to be large. If your estate is very large, you're okay if you cut it a little bit, okay? So where you can cut it a little bit, we don't see migration being so much affected by it. And last, we also like have a prediction for what children do with this money that now they can invest abroad, and they seem to be going in places where there are more opportunities, so places in which you have more free land. Last, the implications. So this is the migration that we observe in our data, and we can run a counterfactual with what would have happened without the invasion and without the abolition of Napoleon, and that's where we take the 25% out from. So the findings of this paper is that this switch affected the probability to migrate for noble peoples, and we know that noble peoples, Neil knows this very well, are kind of like first movers in terms of like for changing demographics. We show that this was relevant when it comes from out-migration from Italy, and therefore these decisions laid the groundwork for the later large-scale migration. So let me conclude by, of course, like in the 250th anniversary of the Wealth of Nations, I had to conclude with a relevant quote well known by Adam Smith. No surprise, I guess, here, but he said 250 years ago that the right of primogeniture still continues to be respected as one of all institutions the fittest to support the pride of family distinctions. It is still likely to endure for many centuries. In every other respect, nothing can be more contrary to the real interest of a numerous family than the right which, in order to enrich one, beggars all the rest of the children. So I like this quote a lot because 200 years ago, Adam Smith already knew something that economists and demographers are constantly rediscovering over and over. And that's that inheritance rules do not simply determine who gets wealth after death. They determine important things in the life of individuals. Today we saw that it changes fertility decisions, it can change marriage, it can change migration patterns. That's all I have.
Thank you very much indeed. That's a huge amount of data and ideas and sort of evidence you've brought here, touching all sorts of aspects of what we work on with economic history and areas, and just been fascinating. Thank you. There has been a lot there. I'm assuming there's going to be a lot of questions from the audience. that want to pick up on some of these and maybe get some more detail on some of it. So let me see, any questions from the audience, please? Albrecht, I saw your hand first. Sorry, microphone, yes please, you will.
Thank you so very much. Albrecht Ritschl, Economic History Department. There is an older literature trying to link partible inheritance to proto-industrialization. And I'm wondering, I mean, you kind of washed out the whole industrialization topic very early on in your talk, and that's very understandable. But I'm sure you have thought about it.
Well,
so I'm wondering if you've any
probably
results.
Probably an upcoming project, a big project, yes.
So the idea is basically, if the cells become too small, it creates a huge incentive to go into cottage industries and proto industry, which is what the old literature is telling us.
Yes, and you already saw that in the debates of the revolutions. Actually, you had we were talking with someone exactly about that. So the revolutions were putting that on the table as okay, egalitarian inheritance will harm the agriculture activity in France, and some would say, no, if we give like to everyone its little share, everyone will make the best use of it and it will be better for the economy. So you had both arguments on the table. I think that I will lean more towards the first. So if you are an economy that really depends on agriculture activity, you talk to any farmer, you say, no, for the farm to be as productive as possible, I want it to be concentrated. I need some sort of concentration, not to break it into. But then if you're already in an industrialized development context, it matters less, and you can afford to divide, to make the inheritance law more just, if you want. So I see egalitarian inheritance as a little bit of a luxury type of law in the process of development.
Felix, sorry, at the back.
Hi, I'm Felix, I'm a visitor here right now at the LSE. Great fan of your work, was super interesting to see it all put together this way. I just have one question about the first part you showed about France. So you showed that when the revolution comes and the introduction of partibility, fertility goes down, but it was already trending down before. Yeah. And I'm wondering, what's that makes it trend down before? And it looks almost like it's not just a revolution, but actually the interaction of two factors. And I was wondering, what is that interaction? What is this other thing?
There's a literature that points towards secularization as one of these forces putting that down. Now, it's hard to point to a precise date, because in Malthusian periods, fertility is not super flat like this. It goes in cycles. So you don't even know whether this decline was in part due to the famines that were very much present in the 18th century either. So you might have a little bit of that also declining. So it's very hard for a long series to say, this is when it starts, and which exactly is the reason, I think. Now we have the chance of having a clean, sharp event where you can use difference in difference. And on top of that, we have clean geographical maps in order to say, okay, at 1 kilometer here we have this law, and 1 kilometer here we have this law. So very precisely estimated to update, even augment the different this with the regression discontinuities. Now for the long trend pattern, I will go more into cultural or norm changes in norms types of factors for the rest of the decline. And no demographic transition can be explained with only one factor. There's a series of factors coming either together or sequentially.
Okay, thanks for your interesting and multinational presentation. So something that was very interesting to me is, when you showed I got this visual image of the map of Africa. So correct me if I'm wrong, the countries where they have, because Africa is so big, so it has different trends. The countries where they had the most, hike in fertility were mainly, say, in some Southern Africa, inland, kind of landlocked countries like in Sahel, Mali, maybe Burkina, and then going down to Congo. So the coastal countries are kind of more, they follow more modern trends, if you like. But what I would like to ask, if I don't know if you went deeper into this, the data showed this death. Is there a change, a difference between rural African fertility rate and urban African fertility rate? Because in my experience, when I was in Africa in the cities, and this was, you know, some years ago, you know, middle class and, you know, educated people, they tend to have less children.
For sure. And that's
though they are, for example, they're not very rich and so on, but still they kind of are urbanized and they follow an international trend. I don't know how to put it. So what do you think of it? Thank you.
For sure. I think the application of customary law is very much still present in rural areas, less so in urban areas. So our story is really for rural areas, less so for urban areas, which on top of the fact that customary law associated to family institutions might be leaning more towards statutory law versus customary law, you also have all these determinants of fertility that are very much at place in urban areas, like the prices of the infrastructure, education, access to the labor market, that also affects how many children we'll have. We do an exercise where we compare our effects just restricting to urban areas, and indeed the effect is much smaller.
So I'm going to go to the left here to Neil, if you can show the microphone. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Paula. My question is quite simple. I mean, for me, intellectually, you find these big effects, right? And so it would seem to be that you need to talk about, like, what proportion inheritance is playing in people's wealth accumulation and how many people are receiving an inheritance under different regimes and, mm-hmm. like, plausibly, how many people are calculating at this margin? Mm-hmm. You know, for the fertility story, how many people are genuinely calculating? And so it just seems like, because you find these really kind of large effects, but don't kind of talk about the actual kind of structure of this in terms of what role it plays in actual, like, outcomes, status, wealth, and all the rest of it. So I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yes, so in the context of France, basically we have estimates for how many households were actually owners of their farms, and that's above, the estimates are ranged between 50% till 70%, depends on the sources that you use. So it was quite a relevant amount of people that actually had an inheritance concerns because it was a property that belonged to them, right? Now, in the case of sub-Saharan Africa, like, you don't really, like, in many rural areas, like, the property is not associated with, like, our concept of private property. It's customary property, and therefore it's it also varies custom by custom, and that's also why the inheritance law is still customary, because you don't have private properties. But it affects I guess that if you think of yourself in a context where what you care about is the resources you get from farming or your farming arounds, inheritance is a big issue, because that's the big asset that you will transmit to the next generations. Think in terms of quantity-quality trade-off model. Now we care so much about the education we give to our children. Well, like, in their context, is how much endowments in terms of land you give to their children. It's the same type of, like, a trade-off, numbers versus what I leave for them. One is human capital, the other is physical capital.
Land. No. I ask because exactly that, because it's surprising that inheritance plays the biggest role for the poorest in society, because that's
also
the only place
the
they're
nobles.
Ever gonna...
Look at Francesco.
Oh yeah, that, I'm not disputing that dynamic. It's just more for the bottom 90%, same as fertility decisions. So in a Malthusian economy where you're not going to start a business and make any money because there's no surplus, the only form of wealth is going to be inheritance. But I guess for someone like me, it'd be nice to see the empirics of it.
But for the nobility in France, actually, the one nice anecdote, never went through a law, but actually the revolutionaries wanted to, I told this to someone today, wanted to oblige noble people who would only have one heir, like after the reform, in order to prevent their estate, their castles, from breaking up. So if you are a noble, you have a castle, now I force you to divide it, you don't want, so you have only one children. The revolutionaries thought about that and say, then we're going to force Neil to adopt another two. And like, it was almost a law. They really reflected on that.
I have got one question here online, so I'll come back to people on the floor in a minute, if I may. But this is going to take you outside of the geographical area we've been talking about, so I hope that's okay with you. Has something similar been observed in Eastern Europe, given the structural differences the economies started with, such as serfdom and then communism?
I have no idea.
Fair enough. I did say it was outside your area. It was just to see. Thank
I'm
you.
Sorry.
No, don't apologise. I've got a question on the left there, and I'll come back to the middle.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Just a quick question about the reverse relationship, basically, whether there's any merit to possibly investigate those very probably rare cases in which the law shifts from egalitarian to inegalitarian regime. And I think, and I might be wrong here, I think the Nazi regime did make this law specifically for the farm areas, not for the entire country.
Yeah, there are some rare cases of that, but I know Ireland, some places in Ireland had that.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any chance to look into the impact
few.
Of that reverse relationship?
There are very few, yeah. Because it's natural that people prefer this direction, no? Going from inegalitarian to, so if countries follow a development line, once you switch to egalitarian, you don't go back, unless, I guess, you go back the development pattern as well.
So that shock becomes irrelevant once you have adopted the egalitarian previously, then. So the reverse doesn't matter, is that the
conclusion? Guido Alfani has some examples in his, like, in his articles, he gives some examples of reversals like that, but there are very few.
I'm going to come to some questions in the middle, please. Yes, the lady there, please.
Thank you so much for the talk. I feel like there are a lot of topics that my nation of the Virgin Islands is dealing with right now. But the one that I wanted to kind of focus on is what is noted by Adam Smith some, is it 250 years ago, where you have a trade-off between family distinctions and then making beggars of the rest of the children. So for the presumably parents that are making that decision, what is the actual value of those family distinctions? And in the case with the child that would receive a stipend, how is their life changed with the advent of the possibility of inheritance?
Yeah, so basically, it's not that families like inequality among their children, of course. So why impartible inheritance exists is to preserve something, because you want to preserve a castle, which means power. You want to preserve a farm that has to feed like a next generation. You have to preserve a house. So it's about indivisibility at the end of the day. And then, like, with respect to what the other children do, depends on the case, of course, but like in, like, let's say, like the peasants, the other children usually work at the family farm as labor force. So it's not that they eat less than the heir. At the end of the day, they get to the table and eat. So in terms of a comparison, like the question you point is interesting, because like you could say, why in a partible inheritance area, why aren't they just behaving as if they were in an impartible area, right? And if you put that question into the literature of Moral Hazard, of Bengt Almstrom, then like the answer would be, well, you need one leader. You need one to ensure the coordination in order for like the best is achieved for like the amount of property that we want to preserve. So that would be the answer. It's like it's for the purpose of making the family the best as possible, and we have to sacrifice equality in order to reach that.
Thank you.
Go for Patrick.
Thank you. Patrick Wallace. I wanted to ask about the Italian case, which I thought was really fabulous. You've shown us that this system of inheritance leads to really high rates of emigration.
Yes.
And you focus there on the kind of movement of people. But those people are, in your story, they're also taking capital with them.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could say anything about the implications of losing that much capital out of the country through this kind of surprising inheritance to emigration channel.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. We haven't, so it's hard to get, we tried to get letters from people emigrating. We found some letters. So there's a museum of immigration in Lucca, which is very hard to get the letters from. So my PhD student, like his stuff, very highly recommended. So got some letters from there. Then it's morely for common people, I think, from the end of the 19th century, that do mention that it's thanks to their inheritance that they were able to kind of like pay for the trip and settle in Brazil. So there is evidence. How big it was, I don't know. You know that they were looking for cheap places abroad, but we know that by proxying, like how desert the place of our destination was, what was the soil characteristics, the irrigation issues, but we don't really know how much money they were bringing with them in the suitcase.
But would you think they're taking roughly the same share as they are in that change in your counterfactual immigration versus your real immigration? Show this kind of big shift in the exit of labor, and you motivate that by these people having access to resources, which
yes.
they wouldn't otherwise have had.
Yes.
I mean, some of it's going to be absorbed in movement.
Yeah.
I mean, would it be plausible to say they just take that share?
I guess I'll have to think about this.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Can you pass it back to Mohammed behind you?
Oh, behind.
You.
I have two questions. One about the like the overall umbrella about the inheritance law, and I was thinking the inheritance would matter when there is like the right of land alienation, essentially when people have the right to they have property rights on land, right, and they can alienate it, and then they can not only alienate it, that's very powerful, that they can actually pass it on to the next generation, mm-hmm. right? And in the medieval period and up until early modern period, there was this was not mm-hmm. always the case. Right?
Yeah.
There were a lot of peasants had just usufruct rights or did not have any rights on land, right? So the question of inheritance would not be binding to this group of people. It's irrelevant essentially, right? And so I think my main question is what is I think it's related to Niels. What is exactly the group of people that we're thinking about here? Is this, I guess these have to be landowners, right?
Yeah.
And then what is the contribution of this group of people to the decline of fertility that we observe? Is the fertility decline driven by the poorer segments, by the bottom 50%, or by the landowners? And as an implication of your story, we should observe essentially no effect on land fragmentation. If your story is correct, then there should be no difference in land.
That's something we check in the paper using agricultural census afterwards, and we actually don't see an effect on land fragmentation.
So it's a zero. It should be a zero.
It's
right?
a zero. Yeah.
Yeah. So on the first point, do you have thoughts on this, on the extent to which people had rights on land to the extent
that we know. So we do know the fraction of people who were owners of their farm, and it's quite relevant. Which compared to England, probably it's much more relevant. Here you have much fewer. Owners. In the case of France, it was important because you have a high share of the population who own their little farms.
Even in the Ancien Régime?
In the early modern period. Now, before that, probably not. It's something that, I don't know the trends, but it must have gone up over time until the revolution, which was this 50%.
And then on the second paper, I was thinking the European marriage pattern, the question is not really the partible versus impartible, if I understand correctly, but it's a question of inclusion or exclusion of women.
Yeah.
Because the celibacy decision is women's celibacy, right?
Yeah.
So I haven't read the paper. So do you observe like these differences between exclusion versus inclusion of women in inheritance? Because if women are excluded anyways, then it doesn't matter to the decision of whether they remain celibate or not.
Well, yes, because as a husband or as a potential husband, you prefer a woman with a house than without a house. So this inequality umbrella actually has several trends in the data, in the model. So one, it can be like in an egalitarian inheritance, I can be an heir, you are not. It can be none of us is, and it can be you are and I'm not, right?
And so then there is a gender element as well, right?
There is a gender element that we just use as a stigma for being single. That's just kind of like a level type of parameter to get us like good, like a correct average levels of celibacy. So we assume that women are stigmatized if they end up singles. It's kind of like a love shock, which is very standard in the marriage literature, if you want.
But I mean, in the inheritance itself, isn't it that you can have partible inheritance, but
yes,
women are excluded nevertheless? Right?
Yeah, but that we put in the in egalitarian inheritance part, like box.
Okay, so then the real difference is about exclusion of women, right?
No, because in the marriage market, like you have one scenario where like the brothers inherits and women do not. You have others in which women can be the heiress, for example. That's also inegalitarian.
So right.
When women, like that's the Basque country, for instance, like women can be heiress if they are the first born child, and they are very valuable in the marriage market, and maybe like they're good enough without marrying.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm going to take your question. So could you pass the microphone along? Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Alex Pilacci. I'm studying here in London for my A-levels. I've really enjoyed your talk today. I was just wondering if maybe there were any notable exceptions where maybe you found during your research where maybe like the inheritance laws changed, but fertility, you know, increased despite the change in inheritance laws.
Yeah, that's coming back to the question of whether like inheritance goes always into the direction of from impartible to partible inheritance, or from inegalitarian to inegalitarian. In order to answer to you, I should have looked into like an opposite switch, no? Like one of the implications, okay, if we are egalitarian, we allow inheritance to become inegalitarian, should we see an increase in fertility rates? That's not a recommendation that I would tell like the politicians nowadays that want to boost fertility. Because I think that low fertility also comes with a lot of like development aspects that we do care with the society, and we cannot change those just because we want to increase fertility rates. But to answer properly, we should do kind of like a difference type of exercise with that change in mind.
Your question partly saying where you've actually got more partible inheritance, do you also sometimes see a fertility increase?
Yeah.
So does that ever happen?
Well, here what we try is to isolate just the effect of the law to other things, right? So it depends what other things are in the society.
Thank you. Can we get a microphone to the front just there, Peter? Thank you.
Hi, thank you. I enjoyed that quite a lot, so thank you very much. So I guess I'm curious, you looked at two scenarios. One is France, which was the first demographic transition, but as far as I'm aware, also the longest, slowest.
Yeah.
And then your other example is one also where it's not really transitioning.
It's also slow.
So I'm curious if you looked at other scenarios, regions, countries where the demographic transition was happening faster, where maybe some of these other cultural and other factors were more important, and what that means for your argument.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I hadn't made the comparison on the length of the transitions in both cases, which is true, that that there is also kind of like a commonality there. As I said, I do think that like there are many things entering a demographic transition, things that kind of accelerate. And that's something I think in terms of the agenda of the fertility, understanding fertility transitions, we kind of like are okay-ish in understanding which elements move, shift fertility in which direction, but we still don't know enough like how combined they do it. So basically, maybe they're like A, B, and C that shift fertility along the demographic transition. What if I put A before or C before? Would that make the things slower or faster? I think that's one of the agendas that like someone who is interested in that should do, because we don't really know how combined they play. No, it's what if the industrialization would have happened before the inheritance change in France? Maybe the inheritance change would have had no effect at all on fertility. The inheritance change had an effect maybe because it came before industrialization. Otherwise, maybe nothing would have happened. So I agree, the timing of when determinants come in is very relevant for how quick the fertility will move.
I've got a question at the back there. If you could put your hand up, they'll find you with the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your talk. I found it really interesting. And I just have a more generalized question. I think that I've taken from this how important inheritance was for people and how it can kind of change your social, like where you go in life. You know, in the case of Francesco, he wouldn't have been able to go to Paris as inheritance. And compared to his brother, I think what I'm trying to get at is, do you think inheritance can change social dynamics in within families and how that kind of translates within more of like a personal setting as opposed to like this like economic situation, I guess?
Well, yeah, for sure. The heir had the role of the guardian of the family, you know? So he had the authority and he was the one making sure that he had two roles. One, continuing the lineage, and second, continuing the family estate. So he had an important role, while the rest, because they didn't have this heir title, they were around, maybe they were treated as the heir himself, but they didn't have the ownership. So it certainly changes the dynamic.
Just there, please. Yes.
Hello. I really enjoyed your talk. I really found it interesting how you talked about how in the past inheritance was really important, but you're talking about as well how now, maybe in modern day society, fertility rates are dropping, especially for women. Women are more able to go out into the workforce and work and own their own money. So how do you think that would affect the importance of inheritance, especially for women now? Do you think it plays as much of an impact in terms of celibacy if women can earn their own money? So do you think that they would actually need a man, like now? Or because they can earn their own money, does inheritance actually matter that much for women?
I think that inheritance will always matter. Like, if you think who's the richest soccer player in the world, maybe as an Argentina, I'll tell you Messi. No, it's not. It's the son of. So really, like nowadays, we're in a world in which skills matter a lot, and that compensates for like maybe how much we rely on inheritance. But still, like you see that when people get married, they receive a big share in order for them to form a family, to pay them. Like as soon as you need big investments, like inheritance can change the life of people. Many occupations depend on big investments in order to later shine.
Can I pick up on actually Patrick's question? Because I think it was yours, with migration and economic growth. And do you actually look at what happens? You say, I noticed on your slide, you said that they were, the younger sons selling up moving out, taking it for more profitable uses.
Yes.
And I actually wonder if there's any evidence of remittances coming back as well to the original estates and things, and whether that does feed back into the growth of the origin country, family,
I
and
see.
So on.
I wouldn't know.
I think it is one of the elements, isn't it, with migration, at least more recently.
It's one of the elements that we would need to look into anecdotical evidence letters and like going to Luca, sending my student again to beg for more letters.
See what they're actually sending back. Yes, yeah. 2 bars of chocolate, gold,
he's
or something.
He's good at getting what he wants. So.
Lovely. I've got 2 more questions, so I'll go for you first, and then Max. Okay, so thank you.
Hello. The civil code changed overnight, but the transition to different fertility took many generations. Do you have information on the process by which families saw what happened to children and drew the lesson? We need to change our fertility rate. I mean, what was happening to the children?
To the
large number, which would be reduced.
So it happens quite quickly. We show that in one generation, the different areas had converged to the same fertility. So in 25 years, like, you see the same fertility in areas that were before different.
So in that period, anything on how quickly they realized it's a very bad idea to continue with the previous fertility rate?
Exactly.
How fast did they work out the consequences?
I don't understand.
It seems that it's almost a mathematical deduction. They saw a change in property and instantly changed the fertility rate. But I imagined that it was more complex than that.
Change. Well, like, it gets reduced over 25 years. Of course, if I'm like 39 when the reform arrives, I don't have a lot of time to make one child less or more. If I'm 15, I'm fully capable. So that's the time that we need in terms of adjustment. So it's one generation. That's what we find in the data.
I'm going to give a final question to Max, so if you could indicate. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. I'd like to come back to your Italian case, and in particular the issue of the abolition of the Fideicommissio, because that was a legal institute, remnants of which survived in Central Europe into the 20th century.
Yes.
Central Europe and Eastern Europe after 45, certainly not. But the question is, in essence, does the abolition of the Fideicommissio really imply that this would be equal partition amongst the inheritors, or was there wriggle room that was carried through generations that not necessarily the first son would own all of it and then split up into equal parts for the other children in the family, but rather in quantitatively different proportions, because that could make quite a difference.
No, it's the first, because it comes with this Napoleon Civil Code, which gave to each children an equal share.
Okay, and there was no wriggle room in terms of how to value which types of assets within the family and then follow the law.
So the abolition of the Fideicommesso comes with the Napoleon Civil Code, which imposes equal partition to all the children in the family.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Before we thank Paula, I'm just going to remind you all that we have got a reception after this, which if you go out the doors, it's down towards the left. It's not always easy to find. A bit further down the corridor by the gallery bit. But let's thank Paula for an excellent lecture. Really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.